Hi, this is The Big Screen. I'm Stephen Becker with KERA's Art and Seek. I'm joined by Chris Wagner, the movie critic for the Dallas Morning News. Chris, how are you?
Happy New Year, Stephen.
Happy New Year to you, and Happy New Year to everyone listening to this today. Today on the show, we're going to speak with Bart Weiss. He's the artistic director of the Video Fest and the Video Association of Dallas. He actually just got back from China on a trip with the American Documentary Showcase. So we're going to hear about his adventures in China. And we'll get Chris's rant or rave and get you set up for the weekend. But today we're going to talk about Pariah.
Yeah, Pariah was actually one of the hits of the Sundance Film Festival in 2011. It's the story of an African-American teenager in Brooklyn who knows she's a lesbian but is trying to figure out how to live as a lesbian and how to interact with her friends and especially with her family. Some of the stronger moments in the film boil down to small domestic scenes of negotiations, everything from tense meals together as a family or even the question of what to wear for church on a Sunday morning.
Leave me out of it.
Now go get changed. Dad, what's wrong with this outfit?
Nothing.
See?
I'm not going to argue with you.
Do what she says.
Dad.
Ngawa.
And put on a skirt.
Chris, you hit it right on the head. Pariah really is a series of really what seem like small battles that all add up to larger issues, things about curfew and questionable friendship choices, things like that that parents are always getting on to their kids about. But it's how the main character, Alika, who you heard in that clip, handles the series of setbacks that really kind of makes it an inspirational film, especially for people who have had issues with identity and figuring out where they fit in the world.
Yeah, and one of those people is actually the filmmaker, the writer-director of Pariah's Dee Reese. This is her first feature. She actually wrote the film as a short when she was at NYU. She had her own struggles when she was coming out. She actually came out when she was 27, as opposed to Alike, who's 17. But it is a loosely autobiographical film, as they say. One of the things that works really well is a balance between a very specific character and set of conflicts with a sort of universal theme of trying to fit into a larger society. Reese talked a little bit about that struggle.
Straight, gay, black, white, suburban, urban, wherever you're coming from, I think the identity is a universal struggle, and everybody at some point has felt like they didn't fit in. Everybody has felt like an outsider. So I hope that people connect into the universality of like being yourself, because it's something we all struggle with.
As I said, I think that's one of the things that really works about Pariah. It has this very specific character, and she's going through struggles that are unique to her. It's a very finely etched portrait of her and her friends and her family. She has some friends who already know they're gay. They're not really dealing with the same kind of internal conflict as Alike. Then there's her mom, who wants nothing to do with having a daughter that's gay, even though she suspects that her daughter is, in fact, a lesbian. And her father, who also has his own suspicions, and he has his own problems with his marriage and with his family situation. In a way, he's Alike's primary ally in Pariah. But I think there's something universal about the struggle, as I was saying, to really fit in and figure out who you are in the world, especially at that age. At the same time, it's a very specific kind of story, and it's the kind of tale we don't really see that much on a big screen, about a black lesbian. We don't see a lot of good films about the African-American community to begin with. And to see a film about an African-American lesbian woman trying to come to terms with who she is, it's just very refreshing to see the kind of story that's underrepresented, I think, for the most part on big screens.
Yeah, I agree with you about the universal element to it all, but it really is that specificity that I enjoyed the most about the movie. There actually, you know, have been plenty of movies about gay characters struggling to either come out or blend in or break out from, you know, their societal space. And what I really enjoyed about Pariah was watching it from a totally different perspective. For one thing, most movies, at least most movies that make it into distribution that deal with gay characters are almost always men. So it was nice to see a lesbian that's trying to work through some of these hurdles. And it was also really neat to see it from a minority perspective. And it's a good reminder that gay issues are also a lot of time ethnic specific, if that makes any sense. You know, coming out for a white person is different from a black person or a Hispanic person or on down the road.
Yeah, I think you're right that different communities treat homosexuality differently. There's a different kind of stigma attached depending on where you're from and what your family is like. I was also very impressed with the cast in Pariah. The young star, Etepera Duye, was very good. She actually starred in the short film version of this as well that Dee Reese made when she was at NYU. I also really liked seeing Kim Wayans in a dramatic part. She's, of course, part of the Wayans comedy family dynasty. And here she really lends some complex wrinkles to this mother character, not particularly likable, not a very sympathetic character, but she never becomes a caricature. And I think that speaks to Reese's care in writing even the supporting characters in this film.
But what I liked about the characters is that they pretty much all were complex, and they all had good and bad sides to them, including Alika. You know, I mean, she certainly isn't the model daughter. She breaks curfew. She talks back to her mother. She throws things around in her rooms, you know, so she's no angel. Of course, part of that is her raging against the situation that she's in. But the mother, you know, is a heck of a taskmaster, and as we find out later in the film, has a really difficult time with her daughter's, sexuality. And then the father in the film is never really confirmed, but you get the idea that maybe he's running around on the family. He may even have a second family out there for all we know. And so you put all of these characters in one room that have a lot of good and bad points. And it was the best parts of the film were watching how those good and bad points intersect with each other.
And I also thought it was interesting just to see how Alika could, you know, how she manages the outside world. With her friends, for instance, she just doesn't quite fit in. They're pretty comfortable with their sexuality. She has a sort of a brief dalliance with another character who's sort of a tourist. She might be gay. She may not be. So she really has nowhere to turn at many points throughout this film. And I think that's kind of speaks to the teenage condition in many ways. Yes, some teenage existences are much more difficult and unique and challenging than others. But I think that's one reason why this film will have a broader appeal for bigger audiences.
And along those same lines, you know, Reese does a really nice job of drawing this character in terms of the stages that she goes through and trying to figure out who she is. At the beginning of the film, actually, it took me 5 minutes to realize that this was a woman, to be honest with you, because we see her first wearing a polo shirt and a cap, and she's clearly trying to look like a teenage boy. And as the film goes on, she changes the style of her dress a little bit. She even changes the way she talks and the way she interacts with her friends. And I just thought it was really well thought out in terms of how these kind of like day-to-day changes that a teenager goes with, especially one who's trying to figure out who they are.
Yeah, she sort of has to be a chameleon. And there's that great first scene that you mentioned where she's in a strip club. And we do think that she may be a teenage boy. And we gradually realize she is, in fact, a woman. And then she takes the bus home with her friend, and she has to change clothes on the bus, sort of put on her home uniform so her family can accept her, rather than her harder sort of hip-hop uniform that, you know, she wears to the club, the baseball hat, the baggy polo shirt, etc. So she has to switch even her wardrobe at various times throughout the day as sort of a way to filter through who she is and the different people that she's around. Very, very nicely done.
It certainly put Dee Reese on the list of filmmakers to watch. I'll be real interested to see whenever she comes out with her next feature. This was actually her first full-length feature. A lot of times filmmakers can be really successful when they tell a super personal story like this, something that's basically her story, you may as well say. I'll be interested to see what the next story she tries to tell will be.
I believe she's currently working on a series for HBO, actually. It's sort of in the beginning stages. I think that's one of her next big projects. But yeah, you're right. She definitely is on the radar now, and she deserves to be. She's a talent, and this is a really good film.
When we come back, we'll speak with Bart Weiss. He's the artistic director of Video Fest, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his recent trip to China with the American Documentary Showcase. Our guest today is Bart Weiss. He's the artistic director of the Video Association of Dallas and Video Fest, and he just actually got back from a trip to China with the American Documentary Showcase. So, Bart, thanks for being here, and I wonder if you could start by just telling us, what is the American Documentary Showcase?
Well, the American Documentary Showcase is an organization that sends filmmakers and experts around the country. It's a joint program from the University Film Video Association, which is an organization of film teachers, and the United States State Department. And the idea is that to show American documentaries to people around the world who may not be familiar with American documentaries. And they think, for the most part, that documentaries are government films with, you know, people talking with, you know, talking heads. And the idea of cinema verite, or sort of taking the camera out to the streets to show what's going on, really isn't much of a tradition there. So being able to take films, show films, work with filmmakers around the world is really a great thing. And it also gives people a different vision of who we are as people, which I think is the main reason the State Department is interested in this, because in a lot of places they don't think of America as having poverty. And why would somebody be a doctor treating people on the streets of Pittsburgh? And, wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know Americans did things like that. So it's trying to show not just the, you know, big heroic things, but the small heroic things that we are as people. And independent filmmakers do that, I think, better than traditional Hollywood films that have kind of this large mythology. But the sort of street work that people do, I think, comes across better in independent documentaries.
What kind of films were shown this year? I mean, are you specifically trying to show works that demonstrate a certain kind of American lifestyle?
No, the films are selected by a group of people, and I'm not on them, although I had some sort of input into them. And there's like about 20 films that are selected, and they're for a variety of things. Most of them are sort of social issue films, people doing interesting things, but mostly character-driven films. What was interesting is the film I went to China with was about art cars, which, you know, is not, you know, this big social relevant film. I mean, last year I went with a film about immigration. It was very serious and all the discussions were very serious. And going to China and talking about art cars was amazing because car culture is on the rise there. It's like all over the place. But it's all about conformity. Everybody has the same thing. And the idea of taking this car and transforming it into something that's individualistic, they were like, oh, my God, you can do that? That is so cool. And I totally expect that if I were to go back to China, to Beijing, in a couple of years, you'd see a bunch of art cars.
The art cars are pretty cool.
Yes, they are.
I must say that.
When you showed the film to audiences, a lot of them were students. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
So I'm curious, what were some of the regular questions that you kept getting from these crowds?
Well, they really came into two camps. There was the questions on content about, like, how do you do this? How do you make a car like that? You know, is that legal? Do people get into accidents? You know, what do people say when you're driving it? And things like that. And the other part of it is, like, how do you make that film? You know, how much did it cost? How did you find the money for it? Where do you send a film like this once you make it? How do you shoot it? What do you do? How do you do sound? You know, the very sort of practical things. So the questions were all kind of all over the place.
How would you describe in general the kinds of documentaries that are being made by Chinese filmmakers right now?
Well, China is very interesting, different than the other places I went, which is Pakistan and Nigeria, which did not have very much of a documentary tradition. They would have TV journalism, but not documentaries. In China right now, there actually is a documentary network. Now, I have to remember that TV is controlled by the state. So they have a state-funded documentary channel. So they are making films that are sort of about what's going on in China. They obviously can't be critical of what's going on there. So since you're getting money, and these things are incredibly well funded. I mean, I was sitting there talking to a woman who said, I've got this lot of money to do this film about this cave, and there are these bats, and there are all these interesting things going on. And, we'll send you out here to come and look at it. I mean, they have a lot of money for things they want to do, but they're not in that sense of individual spirit, and they don't have any way of really being critical of the government without, without getting in trouble. The other thing is that there's a lot of cinema verite there, which is kind of in response to sort of government propaganda. And they tend to be a little bit long because verite things let things happen and they tend to go a little longer.
Could you just explain briefly what cinema verite is for people who don't know?
Sorry.
That's okay.
Cinema verite literally means cinema of truth. And it's a matter of, instead of having a sit-down interview, you follow people and allow action to happen in front of the camera. And the idea is the more time you spend with things, the more truth is revealed by small things that you're able to see. And the structure, the artistic material comes through the way you edit material, like Frederick Wiseman or Al Maisholz.
I realize that they probably had to be very careful, but did you get any inkling that anyone would consider making a film sort of outside of the state system, possibly funding it their own way?
Well, there is a little bit of that. I mean, it's around the world, there's a lot of state financing of films, you know, in many, many countries. When you see feature films at that are nominated for the Academy Awards, often they're funded by state governments. Israel, a lot of other places are doing that. And in those cases, some of them are even critical of their countries getting money from their governments. There are some people that are doing some films independently. The problem is, how do they get them out? And I think there is a kind of interest in that. And that's one of the things we talked about as people were we were traveling around. You know, if you make films, go to find ways to get them out. You know, in China, there is no YouTube or Vimeo. They have their own versions of that, but they're not, you know, it's like we're not getting that material here. So they're having trouble getting it, you know, across the borders. But some of that will be happening. And I think as China is growing so much and so many interesting things are going on, we'll be seeing more and more of that. And I did bring some documentaries from China back with me.
Bart, were you in Beijing for the most part?
Yes, I was in Beijing for the whole week.
Okay.
And did you
a lot of smog.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So how did you feel the filmmakers felt about piracy?
Well, piracy is actually a large issue around the world. In both of the other places I went, Nigeria and Pakistan, it was also a significant problem. That for a local producer who's making a film, and this was a big deal in, say, Nigeria, where they have all these Nollywood films, that the next day there would be pirated copies. And in Nigeria, when you stop at a traffic light, there are all these people like with this tree of goods that are trying to sell you. And so it's very hard to have an indigenous film industry if piracy is eating up all your potential profits. And it's made it really a problem. Unless you're getting money from a sale to television, which is happening in China, then there's very little way to sort of make a business. There is a theatrical business that's very thriving in China. But in like Pakistan and Nigeria, those were real problems. And that's one of the reasons why their industries are really suffering.
So is theatrical business in China more Hollywood product or more native product?
Both. They have a good mix of both. And I think that probably more Hollywood films are seen pirated than in theaters. But there's certainly an awareness of Hollywood films, Hollywood stars.
And we were talking earlier about how some of the filmmakers are actually working with some of the pirators.
What some of the discussion I heard was that, you know, the pirators do such a great job with the boxes and their distribution that some of the filmmakers are working deals with the pirators to get the work out. You know, if you're not going to get money on it anyway, at least let it look good and have it done in a kind of a good way. You know, particularly with documentaries. You know, there's kind of two universes. There are people that are trying to make a living doing their documentaries and people who have a cause that they want people to know about. So more people seeing it is, you know, a really good thing, although it definitely makes it harder to make a living and to make your next film.
I would imagine you probably got into some discussions with filmmakers there about things like state control, for instance, or lack thereof in the United States. So how did that work out? How did those conversations work out?
You know, there is a lot of the concern. It's just sort of, you know, the air you breathe. It's what you do. It's like you know what you can say and what you can say. And there weren't as much of that as I expected. There were more of like, what can we do to our cars that can be legal than what can we do for our films?
Bart, thank you very much for being with us today. You can read some of Bart's blog posts on artandseek.org, where he blogged all during his trip to China. So take a look at those if you want to hear more about Bart's trip.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bart.
It's another light week at movie theaters this week. And if you listened to our discussion last week, we told you why that's actually kind of a good thing. It gives you a chance to maybe catch up on some of this late season Oscar bait. There is one wide release, The Devil Inside, which looks like your typical exorcism story that we get every couple of years. Lots of quick cut, scary images of people who look like they might be possessed, intermixed with crosses and priests doing their darndest to get rid of these said demons.
Yeah, good counter programming. You always got to have that. You need a little bit of junk food to go with the filet mignon every now and then.
There's actually some really good specialty programming coming out this week. On today, Friday, Palace Arts Center in Grapevine is going to show 12 Angry Men on the big screen, which I know you and I are both big fans of that film.
Yeah, I think we talked about that a little when it came out on Criterion
right.
Recently. Fantastic film, one of my favorites.
The Midnight series at the Inwood Theater is The Nightmare Before Christmas. I guess they're a little bit late on that, but that story really could be shown any time of year, I suppose.
Certainly Halloween or Christmas. The Saga of Jack Skellington, great Tim Burton animated film.
And then the last thing is the First Sunday Film Club, which is held at the Fort Worth Public Library on Sundays, obviously, is American Graffiti. So if you haven't had a chance to see that in a while, it might be a good chance to check that out with some fellow film nerds over there in Fort Worth. Finally, next week, we get a little better offerings here on big screens. We've got Beauty and the Beast 3D, which I have to say I'm kind of intrigued by because that's a really great animated movie. It was the first ever animated film to get nominated for Best Picture. And I wonder what the animators there at Disney can do with it in the sense of being turning it into a 3D film.
Yeah, the new 3D fad has caught on so much that they're now taking these movies, as Disney would say, from the vault.
That's right, from the vault.
And making them 3D. We're going to see Titanic in 3D in a couple of months as
which
well.
Which I'm also interested in. And the thing that I'll be watching for is that the best 3D movies from the last few years are ones that were actually conceived in 3D and then filmed as such, not the ones that have been retrofitted to 3D. So I'll be interested to see how they're able to make that look seamless and actually see if it adds anything to the story.
I'm curious enough that I'm going to go check out Titanic. It's been so long since I've seen it anyway.
Hey, we'll probably end up talking about that on the show, I'd imagine. Also out next week is Joyful Noise, which I've been seeing a lot of previews for. Looks like a musical.
Dolly Parton and Queen Latifah.
Back together again.
Together at last, yes.
Contraband, that's a Mark Wahlberg action flick. The Iron Lady, which is Meryl Streep channeling Margaret Thatcher. That's actually going to be the subject of our podcast next week.
Indeed it is.
So we will withhold our judgment a little bit there, though we have both seen it. Carnage, which is the adaptation of God of Carnage. I was interested to see that's only 80 minutes long.
Yeah, it's pretty short. It really needs to be pretty short because it's all set in one room. And one couple, these two couples kind of hashing out a bullying incident involving their respective children. And one couple keeps trying to leave and getting pulled back in for more verbal warfare. Great cast, John C. Reilly, Christoph Waltz, Kate Winslet, and Jodie Foster just being vicious as all get out.
We'll talk a little bit about that in more detail on the 13th. And then the last thing coming out next week is In the Land of Blood and Honey, which is Angelina Jolie's directorial debut.
It's gotten really good reviews so far.
Well, before we put a capper on this one, why don't we hear what your rant or rave is for this week?
I have a rave this week. It's a simple Blu-ray release. It's The Lady Vanishes, the classic 1938 Alfred Hitchcock film that's from his British period. His American films are much more celebrated. The Lady Vanishes, made in 1938, as I said, is among his last films made in England. It's a very charming story of spycraft and a couple on a train played by Margaret Lockwood and the great Michael Redgrave, Vanessa Redgrave's father, and Lynn Redgrave's father, of course, a magnificent actor in his own right. It has some of those light comic Hitchcock touches that a lot of the English films had. It has a lot of suspense. It even has a little bit of social and political commentary. It's sort of against appeasement. And this film, of course, 1938, right in the World War II wheelhouse when England was trying to figure out how it would deal with Nazi Germany.
Is there anybody in film history who's used trains to greater effect than Alfred Hitchcock?
Probably not. I mean, you have Strangers on a Train, of course.
Obviously,
you have Lady Vanishes. You have North by Northwest with Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint smuggled away on a train. So,
and don't forget Shadow of a Doubt, where the climactic scene takes place on a train. People are always getting mixed up on trains, getting thrown out of trains, pulled into trains.
And, of course, there's the great Throw Mama from the Train, which is the comic adaptation of Strangers on a Train.
Hitchcock, I think, just realizes, hey, we can have drama in a situation, but you know what makes the drama more amped up? To have it be moving at 80 miles an hour.
And it just seemed so novel. He did it so well that it seemed like a new thing when, in fact, train movies go back to the beginning of Hollywood.
The very beginning of Hollywood.
Before Hollywood, even. I mean, if you want to talk about the first train, the Lumiere brothers train arriving at the station, and where allegedly people watching it in the theater ducked because they thought the train was going to hit them. That's actually recreated in Martin Scorsese's Hugo. That story has kind of been debunked now, but it's still a great apocryphal bit.
That's going to do it for us this week. For all of Chris's movie reviews, visit DallasNews.com.
And you can keep up with everything happening in the North Texas art scene with Stephen and the rest of the cast at KERA's ArtandSeek.org.
We'll see you next Friday with more talk of the big screen. Until then, be sure to subscribe to the Big Screen Podcast on iTunes.